This is the Roaring Elephant podcast. And before we do anything other stupid in our pre-recording fun time, let's go back to our regular scheduling, which means we connect back to our guest that we introduced last week, Mr. Purandar Das, CEO and founder of Zotero, talking to us all about data, the good things, the bad things, and the great things, the things in between, the other things, all the things.
It's protection.
Everybody needs protection. No,
yeah.
Okay, too deep. Cool. Let's stop all the pleasantries and just move on to the next part of the interview, which is going to be the final part of the interview. So enjoy. And
if we look at something kind of from a slightly different perspective, what are some of the kind of the technical pieces that you would use to provide this kind of solution? You know, you mentioned things like key rotation, and I'm assuming you've got, you know, a variety of different types of encryption used as part of this. You know, you've got, presumably also you've got like differing types of users. You've got some users where they, like maybe an analytics type user doesn't need to see the actual data, but the data needs to be representative. And then you've got other users and other processes that actually do need the actual data, but maybe they don't need all the data. They only need the, you know, some of the data. So, you know, what are some of the kind of technologies that are implemented in order to kind of achieve these variety of different scenarios?
Essentially, that's just describing the product. Now, I'll start with something different that you've opened up with key management and key rotation, et cetera, right? When you talk to most security folks or most technical people and you tell them you have a solution for security or data protection, they immediately jump into what you said. What's the key rotation? How does it integrate? Which kind of illustrates one of the challenges and the failure in approaches in the past. Products are extremely complex and require the users, right, or the teams to be extremely conversant with various different technologies, which extends the deployment cycle, the skills needed, and the challenges associated with deploying a product. Typically, that's where teams and organizations start to cut corners, saying this is too complex, let's not do this, which can obviously result in less than optimal or suboptimal security. One of the things we did in the platform and said is we want to provide company, when you log into an app on the phone, you don't have to think about a whole lot of things other than the objective that you want to achieve. That's our approach to the product. It's like the product does everything, but we don't need it to be an expert in anything other than setting it up and telling the product where the data is and who the user is and what they should see. That's the way we build the product, right? Because that making the product easier to consume or to deploy within an extremely complex ecosystem was one of the first design objectives that we knew we had to achieve to make this product effective. If I went into an organization and told them it's going to take you 18 months to deploy this to protect this database, great, they get the idea, but 18 months is a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Where we walk in and say it's going to take you 2 weeks to get the product deployed and be up and running in your data protected, right? That's been the design approach, and that's one of the things. In terms of what we do, what the platform does, right, in terms of capabilities, once the product is up and deployed, we tell we tell our users to say, what are the data assets you want to protect, right? Obviously, this prioritization when an organization has hundreds of data assets. We say, point the product to the data asset, because we're going to go in there, scan the data set, and tell you what the sensitive attributes or confidential information in this data asset is. We tag those assets, we classify them, and then we bundle them as to how they relate to different regulatory requirements, whether it's GDPR, HIPAA, PCI DSS. We say, here's the attributes that would roll up for protection that's required under these different categories, right? Once we do that, we talk about encryption. We have multiple levels and multiple mechanisms for encryption. Mm-hmm. Does the data need to be queried as is without decryption, which is a patent we hold? So we have a specific way of encrypting data. to your point, analytic people need to see the result, need to see the output, but they don't need to see the details. So we offer masking, where the results, when they're displayed, are masked so that the end user, for a customer service center, right, they just need to know it's you by looking at a few bytes of data, but not the entire thing. We offer data masking, right? Then we provide privileged access management or role-based access control as the industry is aware of it. So we map back to the different roles, the users within the organizations, whether they're analytic users, they're administrative users, they're transactional processes that require access to the data. And then we enforce those the privileges as the process of the user comes to ask for data. While we're doing all this, every request is being processed through a machine learning model that says, based on the different factors within this request and based on the past behavior, the model can identify an anomaly, right? If it's somebody pretending to be me going to sensitive data that I've never looked at before, it's immediately going to flag it and say, hey, we think it's an anomaly here. We're going to stop this request till somebody validates that this is the same guy who's somehow going to a data set that he's never looked at before. So we use the same approach to detect ransomware as well. We look at what's happening at disk level, and the machine learning model is able to identify a machine learning pattern through a machine learning process, a ransomware attack as it develops. The model takes about less than 2 minutes to identify a pattern, an attack pattern as it develops. It's able to stop it, isolate it, and notify people that a potential attack has happened, but it's been contained, and here's possibly what objects have been impacted.
Nice.
Great question. Sure. When you talk to people, organizations about these data sets, do you have a feeling that they are aware of where their issues might lie? Or is it more often that it's completely thunderstruck? Oh, we didn't even know we had that data. Kind of the question is, how mature are the people already before you step in? How sophisticated are they in thinking about their data in this way?
They range across the spectrum, to be candid. In some of the more highly regulated, well-funded industries, they're very familiar with it. And the attitude and outlook there is, whatever we can do to improve what we have, we want to do, right? And that's their approach to us, in saying, you bring something innovative and something unique that we don't have. We want to look at it because you offer a better level of protection that we don't have. You're a backstop in the event that we get breached. You're helping us consolidate capabilities, improving efficiency, making the security processes faster. In other industries, they go, well, can you tell us where our data set is? We've got a cloud environment that people have used, adopted for the last, we don't know what they've created. Can you first go scan in there? We don't know what policies we have. We don't know what users have access. So yeah, the range, it ranges across the spectrum.
Now, also the examples you gave are mostly GDPR kind of privacy things, social security numbers, birth dates, things like that. Now, those are things that are fixed formatted, so easy enough to scan about. But I can imagine that companies like, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, their secret recipes, things like that, for them, that is also very important data that's not under any kind of compliance regulation. And I would assume very hard to discover because it's just chemical formulas, text, recipes, things like that. How does that differ in detecting when you look at this stuff between the a social security number, you know, that's the format, you can easily do a regex and find that. But this kind of free text stuff, how does that differ?
Yeah, actually, fantastic question. And that's one of the approaches we differ in as well. Our data discovery and classification process is actually grounded in a large language model. We use contextual discovery, and our discovery capabilities range across from scanning images and using OCR to recognize sensitive information in there, to contextual discovery and classification within the thing. But regex is also part of it, because a lot of organizations say, I just want to use this to discover a account number or thing. So we use a combination of contextual discovery as well as regex-based pattern discovery.
So as we've been kind of talking about this, like you mentioned, like the sort of legislation kind of differs in different parts of the world. There's kind of different levels of organizations caring about these kind of things depending on where they are. How do you see that kind of playing out when you're talking to people, especially in a globally distributed, organization, large multinationals, where the regulations for the folks in EMEA differ greatly to those in the US who deliver differently to those in India or Singapore, or like how does a global organization sort of handle their kind of data privacy kind of logistics when it starts to kind of spread across all these different boundaries and areas?
So from a data protection or a data security perspective, the regulations don't really differ that much. When mm-hmm. you normalize what the regulations are asking for is to a couple of things, right? One is they're saying identify sensitive attributes as it relates to my constituents, whether that is a country, a region, or a thing, or a state, right? They're saying, first of all, identify what data you collected about my constituents. Second, protect the sensitive attributes of that data set. And the sensitive attributes, for the most part, are the same across the board. It's the same with the standard ones, right? Some kind of identifier, the birth date, the name and address, any identifying information like email, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The other thing they say is limit access to that data set for people that are allowed to use that access. So it's more of an access management request as opposed to do something special with the data. The other one is when you monetize or you act the data, use the data to do something, there are specific regulations about who can reach out to them, what you can reach out to. So it's more of a limitation on the access and use as opposed to doing anything with the data. From a data perspective, the requirements are, for the most part, normalized and pretty clear across the board.
Okay, that's good to know.
So that always been the case, or is that a more recent thing that they called community homogenized? Because I can imagine before GDPR, GDPR has been kind of a uniformization force across the world because it's more kind of the strictest level. And if America wants to do business with us, they kind of have to follow suit. They don't have much of a choice. Yeah. But before GDPR, I'm imagining it's much more of a wild west out there in what was in different countries.
I mean, truly, prior to GDPR, there weren't many regulations. Hmm. Right? GDPR is the leader and has been the leader in that effort. And I think, there's certain variations and differences in every country's thing because they have to add their twist and their needs to it. But for the most part, I think GDPR has served as the leader or the framework for countries and organizations creating and enforcing regulatory needs. And GDPR, outside of a few countries I can think of, GDPR still continues to be one of the strongest in terms of what they require from a privacy and a data security perspective.
Yeah, you.
It's good. It really is good.
Yeah. When it comes to where people are storing their data nowadays, obviously, there's a large amount of data still held on-prem, but I can imagine that there's an equally very large amount of data being stored on the various cloud providers. Does that complicate things? Does that simplify things? Having the cloud providers in the mix, how does that change the picture when it comes to data protection?
So one of the misunderstandings is, and you're true with the statement that a lot of organizations are still moving to the cloud and they're not there yet, right? In fact, it's kind of shocking to see how nascent that adoption is in many ways. But it really is not the perspective to look at data security from. Because an organization has to have just one application that they've adopted or moved to the cloud, and the data's there. It doesn't matter that they don't have all of their applications or data sets there. It just matters that they have one that has sensitive information in there. That's the vulnerability. That's all that's needed, right? So that kind of is like the that's the perspective we look at the data security issue from. Because if you look at a couple of the more recent breaches, they were data that was stolen off of one of the largest cloud services or database cloud services, and they got a lot of data off of one platform.
Mm.
And that's all you need, right? That's the vulnerability. From a cloud services perspective, I think they've done a great disservice in terms of data security and protection, because in their push to get organizations to adopt their services, they've said the cloud is secure. It's more secure than your on-premise thing. And here's a list of things that we've done, right? And like, nobody actually sat down to say, why is it more secure and how is it more secure than what we spent years and millions of dollars securing on-premise? Nobody, they all just wanted to hear the cloud service provider say, we are secure. And the internal team said, it's the cloud the service provider's responsibility. It's not mine anymore. Nobody actually sat down to say that the cloud service providers, the cloud services are not probably just as insecure as what you did on-premise, or in many cases less than, because the application providers didn't really prioritize security. They were prioritizing application or services development.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very different world. And it's also like any breach is still a breach. You know, any way in, whether it's through the one application you have deployed or the hundreds of applications you have deployed, you know, breach is a breach, an exploit is an exploit. And if someone can trigger something, then they will. Looking at this again from a sort of a different perspective, you know, what are the recommendations that you would make for individuals who are concerned about their personal data sort of being monetized, being exploited? You know, what would you recommend that individuals can do, if anything?
So there are a lot of things they can do. And I think the primary thing is being aware, and whether, I mean, you can phrase that as education, being aware and being cognizant of everything that you do as an individual. We don't live in an era where you can do a lot of things that don't have consequences from a digital perspective, right? So thinking about every email that you look at, every link that you click on, every text message that you get, every interaction you have, every phone call that you receive, I think that awareness is probably the single most important thing, because from a consumer perspective, right, from a consumer or an individual perspective, everything that happens requires the individual to participate in some way, inadvertently trigger or inadvertently act on something. Clicking on a thing or providing a little bit of information, getting scared, not taking the right steps. So awareness, educating people, I think is the single biggest thing. And it's really no different from what organizations stress on, right? I mean, humans, human beings are the biggest weakness. I'm sure you heard this. And they say training, security awareness within organizations is the most critical thing. Similar. On an individual level, awareness, in my opinion, is the single biggest thing.
Interesting. Yeah. It ironically, it's also one of the most difficult things to effectively like try and drive is kind of real change and awareness to the masses of what is actually happening, and you know what they can do about it. You know, it's and one thing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And the other thing that complicates it on an individual level is the generational gap, right? Different generations have different perspectives of what data, what privacy is, what security is, and how much they're willing to engage and lose. You, on the far end of the spectrum, you have people that won't even touch a phone or click on an email because they're scared about everything. On the other side of the spectrum, nothing scares the younger generation, and no law. They for them, there is no such thing as loss of privacy, because they put their entire lives out there already. But they don't. I mean, it's still making them aware of what the long term damage of putting the stuff into the digital realm, I think, is extremely critical, because what they put out today will follow them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I don't think we actually know what the effects will be, because this new generation is only now reaching their 30s, 40s.
Exactly.
And yeah. Yep. It's worrisome.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that's obviously making a big impact at the moment, everywhere, in every industry, even if it's only hype, Jon's going to put his fingers in his ears now, is generative AI. So, you know, what are you seeing in the kind of data protection space that is, that you think are problems that generative AI can actually reasonably solve? And if you have ideas, like, what do you think is the craziest idea that you've heard that you think is definitely still a pipe dream?
I mean, every idea in the AI, for the most part, in the AI space, for the most part, these days are crazy, because everybody's dreaming of crazy things. I mean, literally, that's where we are. I mean, I think I'm sure you've been reading articles about NVIDIA start getting blown up these days because they think it's overhyped after that initial thing. Mm-hmm. We are still going through that early phase, in my opinion, right? And this may sound crazy, but generative AI is new, but AI itself conceptually is nothing new, right? What's been made possible through technology is the vast aggregation and the ability to process massive amounts of data that have never been possible before. That opens up a new realm of things. I mean, there was a period here, a year ago or less than that, when people were worried about jobs being lost wholesale because AI was going to replace everything. Mm. And now that's no longer. So we're going to go through a lot of these gyrations for a little bit of time, I think. From a security perspective, in terms of what it's already facilitating, unfortunately, is a lot of attacks and hacks that are becoming more feasible because anybody can reach in there and say, show me some vulnerabilities or how is this done? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, that is the case. I think companies are still building platforms and AIs that can help improve security. Adoption of that is still kind of going to be slow. There is just a lot of, every company's website now says, we use AI. What they use it for, it's up to you to imagine. I think the impact is still ongoing.
Yeah.
But one of the things I heard that Gen AI is being used for is to have a better, when you're assembling different data breaches together, doing that assembling through Gen AI apparently has some advantages to get meaningful connections pop up, which you wouldn't see if you just have two Excel sheets next to each other, for example.
Excel
sheets,
yeah.
So that's point of view.
Yeah.
Now, when you were talking about this, was quantum computing is one of my hobbies at the moment, and it doesn't exist yet. Don't let anybody tell you differently. But I do hear that a lot of data gathering is happening of encrypted data that is encrypted to a point that can't be breached. But they expect that when quantum computing actually becomes something, they will be able to break it. So they're already capturing all the encrypted data as well. So from your point of view, does it make sense to encrypt your data in the end? They're going to crack it anyway. Should we just forget about encryption altogether then?
So it does and it doesn't, right? For the most part, worrying about quantum encryption, breaking today's encryption somewhere down the line, I think is overrated because data is very contextual and time sensitive. If you take today's data for the most part and you attempt to break it 15 years later, great, you did something scientifically or technically, but what use is the data, right? Mm. But if that data set happens to be defense, something else, yeah, sure, it makes a lot of sense, right, to collect. And I think when people talk about that data being collected, my opinion, and I don't have any facts, is that it's mostly on the side where it's going to be meaningful to crack that encryption somewhere down the line. For the bulk of the data, you absolutely have to encrypt it. And people, the other question we get asked is, how does your product work with quantum encryption? Are you what happens if to your point, it doesn't exist. When it exists, our platforms will use that as the way to encrypt data. Quantum computing or quantum encryption benefits both perspectives.
Yep.
Right? You'll have stronger encryption, but the ability to break today's encryption, which won't exist then, so we're not yet worried.
The arms race continues.
Exactly. Yep.
So basically, you're saying that nobody is grabbing my encrypted WhatsApp chat. So when I write my somebody writes my memoirs in 50 years, that won't be useful anymore. I mean, I have meaningful conversations.
I mean, if you got my password today and I'm dead 50 years from now, what's the point?
I don't know. We'll see in 50 years.
We'll find out. Well, it's been fantastic talking to you, Paranda. If people are kind of listening and they're interested in understanding more about kind of data protection and what their options are and how to do it, what's the best way to contact you?
Just come up to our website. It's www.soterosoft.com. And reach out to me on LinkedIn, reach out to us on LinkedIn. We're on Twitter as well. So multiple ways, easiest ways to go to the website and get a sense for what we do and see and reach out to us if you think we can help you. We're happy Fantastic. To talk even if we can't help you.
Fantastic. Well, it's been really interesting chatting with you, Paranda. It's this whole challenge around data protection is definitely something that's not only not going away anytime soon, but is going to continue to kind of challenge organizations for the foreseeable future, as long as they carry on collecting data. And as you said, the world is run on data, so I don't see that changing anytime soon either.
Yeah, it's not going away anytime soon, and we're not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, we're not going to stop.
Thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Fantastic. Well, take care, and we'll speak soon.
Bye-bye. Yeah.
And there we go. That concludes our discussion with Paranda from Sotero. Really, I say, a different type of conversation to some of the ones that we've had in the recent past, but very interesting discussion nonetheless, and not something that's going away anytime soon, I feel. If anything, you know, this area is only going to get more and more important and almost certainly more and more competitive as well, as people realize the challenges that are in this space. But yeah, great discussion. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, things only get worse before they get better, I think. But if more people follow Paranda's example, I'm going to the is it the white side? If you have the dark side and this is the white side, we never say that, do we?
Yeah, stepping into the light.
Now that's something else. No, please. You don't wish your guests dead. Come on. Anyway, big thank you to Paranda for suffering through an episode or two with us. It was very great to have him on the show. Great discussions.
Indeed. And with that, unless there's anything else from you, Jon?
Take it away.
Then that is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon, and really every contribution does help. We are on YouTube. You can like, subscribe, hit the notification bell, even comment. And we've had an interesting comment on one of our recent videos that I'll be replying to later. So thank you for that. Please do all the YouTube things. You can also go to roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page and for more information about the podcast, and send any feedback that you have to podcast@roaringelephant.org. Until next time, my name is Comment Worthy Dave.
And my name is not just ready to go into the light just yet, Jon.
We look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you then. From the light.